Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
It's just crazy kids.
Good morning, Hezzy. It's Johnny,
morning,
as usual,
everybody.
And Lori right behind.
Still trying
all
to
right.
figure out what I'm going to be when I grow up.
Trying to catch up here. How are you, Hezzy?
I'm doing exactly the same thing, John. Is that when you find the answer, give me a call.
I don't want to grow up. I've seen what happened, though. I just as soon stay a child.
Yeah, but you know something? It's tough to be married to Peter Pan with a white beard. I'll tell you that.
Hey, you seem to manage pretty well, I think.
Actually, I wouldn't have
it. I don't know how
way.
You do it, Lori, because I know I don't think I could do it.
And you know, Hezzy, there,
me either.
There are
do
days
it.
That I wonder if I can. No, I'm kidding. He's the best husband in the world. He's, except
all
for that
the, all
one
the more
time.
And,
oh, then there was
a car and drive
and,
away.
Really?
Yeah.
Drive into the sunset. Hezzy, you are fully 20 degrees cooler than we are here in Pinehurst, North Carolina. It has been sweltering hot, and all I can say is thank God for two things, whole house air conditioning.
Amen.
And the fact that the electric company is keeping it going.
Yeah, amen to that one, too.
You're going to have a hot day
tomorrow.
Just check. Oh, it's
that's
it's,
what
it's,
I hear.
It's
that's
be
what I hear. Very hot.
Massive.
Yeah.
91 in New York tomorrow, but then it's going to cool off. We have had near 100-degree temperatures now for almost a week, continuing into next week. It's brutal, except for one fact. We live in the Sandhills, which is 2 hours west of the Atlantic, of the coast, of the North Carolina coast.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, you know, millennia ago, I mean ages and ages ago, the Sandhills
right.
of North Carolina was oceanfront property. Of course, times changed, and as a result, though, our soil is actually white sand.
Okay, hold on a second. I want to put you on speakerphone because we have a guest here who's listening into it.
Okay, and as a result,
okay.
we have very dry heat, and that's our gift.
Yeah, just like Phoenix, mm-hmm. it's a dry, yeah, right.
But it's still hot, so in any case, mm-hmm. on that happy note, before Johnny has to bow out, I'd like Johnny to talk first, obviously, about the flavor of the week, which was the Hyundai 2022 Tucson Limited PHEV all-wheel drive, which was a breath of fresh air. Johnny, I'd like you to speak about the motor, the gas and electric combination, and the consumption in that order.
Uh-huh.
Take it away, Johnny.
Do you get the feeling that I'm sort of being, like, run off of the show by this person who has now assumed responsibility for the entire thing? Here, Johnny, here's what you talk about.
It happens every week. It happens every week, John.
Yeah.
You just noticed it this week.
Otherwise, I wouldn't be driving you crazy, honey.
Exactly.
And listen, your words were never spoken. We did have a wonderful car. Been having electric cars, and what we had this past week was the Hyundai Tucson that is both electric hybrid, that's both electric and gas, and it had some innovations I thought were really, really cool and a step in the right direction in what they're trying to achieve with electric cars. The older hybrids, like they've been old, but the hybrids that we've had in the past were pretty much the battery charged when you hit the brakes, and that was usually the primary way that they charged it. This one had a plug-in so that you could actually charge the battery in your garage or carport, and also on the other side it had a gas tank where you could put gasoline in it. So you had both ways to charge up or fill the vehicle. And while the mileage using just the electric, it would only go 35 miles.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot better job of marrying the gasoline and the electric so that the average of both of those was 80 miles per gallon, which
That's
is
beautiful.
Really, really good. Yeah, it is good. And then the other thing that they did, which I thought was really spectacular, it's only a four-cylinder engine in the vehicle, and I think it's turbo. Lori's probably got the sheet. But it's four-cylinder. But you know how in any of these cars, and I always talk, or a lot of times I talk about this, when you step down on the gas, even in a turbo, there's a hesitation while the four chipmunks decide what it is that they think you want them to do, and then they jump into action. But what they've done with the Tucson is they married that electric technology, which, if you'll remember about the Tesla, one of the big things mm-hmm. was it would go from 0 to 60 in like 2 seconds or, you know, some incredible thing because there was no hesitation. Well, they've married that in with the gasoline engine so that when you're in the Tucson and you step down on it, there's an instant response just like it was in the electric cars. And then wow. it moves the gasoline engine depending on the terrain. If you are on a flat level surface and you're up to 60 miles an hour, it generally stays with the electric source. When you start up an incline, even a slight one, and this is one of the things Lori can talk about, the noise, but when you start up an incline, even a slight one, it will relate over to the gasoline engine, and you can sort of hear it, which is a little bit disturbing, but you can tell when it's going from electric to gasoline, and then when you get over the hill, for example, and start downhill to level out, all those kind of, you can see it because there's a line that shows you how, whether it's going into electric or not, there's a line that shows you that it's moving back into the electric current part and, the, you know, gets really quiet again. It's just, you can tell they are moving in the right direction. They have the right thinking. It's still a slow process. But here's one that you can plug into the wall and charge up the battery, and it's not going to take that long because it doesn't do that much. And you can put gas in it and run it that way. So I really like this. And the battery, we never had to plug it in. It always had a charge. I'm not saying it was charged up, but it never was fully discharged. And it just made for a really good combination. The best I've seen so far. As far as Mary mm-hmm. Go, honey.
Well, the thing about it is, you know, we've been talking the past couple of weeks about all electric cars, which we've been test driving, and the cars themselves, fabulous. But the problem is the recharging station. And as we pointed out last week, our nearest fast, there are fast recharging mm-hmm. stations, and there are recharging stations, and then there's your own, you know, electrical outlet in your garage. Well, the fast recharging stations are great. They'll charge an electric car up to 80% in 15 minutes, and then if you want to go a full 100%, it's going to take another 15 minutes. So half an hour for a full charge at a fast charging station. This is not anything that you can or have got in your home. You've got an electric mm-hmm. outlet. Now, the charging stations, of which we have quite a few around Pinehurst, will do the same job as a fast charging station in 8.5 hours. So tell me really, I mean, how realistic is that? The beauty about...
I've got to ask you a question. Is it conceivable that you could put in a special circuit in your garage? So you could do a quick recharge every day.
I don't know about the quick recharge because that's an 800 volt direct current.
That's something that houses just don't have. That's a massively big current of electricity.
I got you. Okay.
It's already 220 volt in your house,
which is why it takes long. But, you know, even so, you go to our closest fast charging station is an hour and 15 minutes away. And when you can only get, you know, 200 or 300 miles on a drive, we're not going to go an hour and a half away to charge our car basically 4 days. We're not.
Mm-hmm.
So about this Hyundai is the fact that you've got both. You've got the beauty of being able to drive distances because it has a gasoline backup, and you also have the beauty of getting as much as 80 miles per gallon, and then small e, electric. It's MPG, capital MPG, then small e, miles per gallon electric. 80 miles combined city and highway. That's phenomenal. But if you're driving a distance and you can't get to a fast recharging station, then you don't have to worry. Your car is still going to go. All electric car, you got to plot out, you know, your route meticulously, or else you're going to have to call AAA.
Well, and yeah, on this one, talking about charging the battery again, on this one, on the Hyundai Tucson, 2022 Hyundai Tucson, when you slowed down, it would kick into charging the battery, and when you applied brakes, it would charge the battery. Uh-huh. So instead of just using the brakes, you had two opportunities to charge the battery. So that's what I said. We might have gotten down to 25% capacity on the battery, but the battery never went below 25%. We always had electric charge. Mm. So we got that good gas mileage because it was going back and forth between the electric and the gasoline.
And also because when it's going only on electric power, you're still going to get 33 miles of all-electric power, which means you're not having any gas anyway. So, I mean, this is the perfect solution. And, again, it's not the car companies. It's the fact that government has demanded that we are going to be all-electric by, I don't know, what is it, 2026 or something? And the fact is that's not even realistic. There are not going to be fast-charging stations within 5 miles of every home in the United States, number one. Number two, we still don't have batteries perfected to be able to go more than, you know, 300 miles. Also, what happens when a battery has to be thrown away? We talk about saving the environment. Batteries, you know, you just don't throw them in the dump. That's a whole other pool of fish, and it's a very big one. So what's happening is it's the cart before the horse. The technology for designing and building these wonderful cars is certainly there, but we
evolving.
Don't have the support.
Yeah, it's really evolving, the technology, to do what they're trying to do. And this was a good example of the evolution of the technology in gasoline and electric. Tell them about the comfort and stuff, though. That's really important in this.
Well, ours was white. We always talk about color. And ours was quartz white with a, are you ready for this, a gray interior, which basically was it was gray. And so it was not a flamboyant color combination like some cars we've had that we've gotten that are lime green with orange, bright orange interiors. So it was a very subdued, but it was a beautifully designed car. And one thing that was remarkable, especially with the fact that it's a hybrid, tons of space in the front passenger seat, second row seat, lots of storage in the back, very high head clearance. Johnny never had to knock his head on the, you know, when he got into the car. Lots of leg room, really just a joy. And so
heated and air-conditioned seats.
Heated and air-conditioned seats, separate, you know, dual control.
Heated back seats.
And dual climate control heated up front. So when Johnny wanted one temperature and I wanted another, we didn't get into a discussion. The only thing I have to say, and we both did this, we were driving to Raleigh Airport to pick up Johnny's business associate and friend, Dave Cruz from New York City.
Who's sitting in the room with listening to the radio.
Dave's waving.
Hi, Dave.
Wave, Dave.
Dave is waving.
Hello. Well, listen, Dave was a passenger in this car. We picked him up in this car. Give us your thoughts about it.
I loved it. It was really comfortable. I was really, really happy with some of the safety features the car also had. I was sitting in the passenger seat, and I noticed when John was hitting the blinker, on the dash itself, the screen popped up and showed you or gave you visual of the blind spot right in your dash. It was pretty amazing. I love the car.
Dave joins Johnny in the sporting his company, Country Pursuits, out of New York City, and Dave travels all over the world enjoying Country Pursuits. And so there he's come down to us. In Pinehurst to work with us. But Johnny's known Dave forever, and I've known Dave beyond forever when he was one of the managers of Holland and New York City, and before that with Ralph Lauren. So we're lucky to have him and delighted to have him. And as he said, the car impressed him as well. Now, one thing also that I found impressive, and Johnny already touched on this, the pickup is instantaneous. It's not a jolt. It's very fluid. When you put the pedal to the metal, it's not like you go jumping. You don't. But it's the kind of fast pickup, frankly, that you would expect in a sports car. The noise, as Johnny also pointed out, that was a little bit of an issue for me, because whenever the car really kind of changed over from gas or gas and electric to electric or went uphill, suddenly the car started talking to you. You heard it.
Backwards. You got it backwards. When it's electric, it's quiet. When it changed from electric to gas, that's when you'd get the noise.
That's why I love you, Johnny, because you always watch out for me when I, and he's absolutely right. That's what I really meant. But that
write that down. Johnny was right.
Well, Johnny listens.
Write that down.
Johnny listens.
Hey, put that on your pad of paper.
I will.
Time and date. So, and that really, that was, I mean, and so when I say that, though, remember, Johnny and I were looking for flaws. Nobody else would pick up on this. We review cars. We always try to tell you, our listener, what we see and what we feel and what we think.
Let me tell you something else along those very lines that you're talking about. We don't play the radio. We tend to listen to the car. We try to, generally we're having conversation anyway, but we don't listen to the radio. If you're driving down the road and you had the radio on, you wouldn't even have noticed this. But we did, because we didn't have the radio on, and so you can hear the noise. Even when it's electric, you know, you hear the noise of the tires on the pavement. But, you know, they've done a good job with the technology of actually subduing all of that noise. I'll tell you how good it is, I think. When you put this car in reverse, you know, if you've ever been on a construction site or even downtown and you have a truck that starts to back up, you know, it goes beep, beep, beep. Well, the car does that. But if you're inside, you barely even hear it. But Lori was backing out of the driveway, and I was standing outside while she was backing out, and, I mean, it was loud. So they've done a great job of controlling the noises outside the car so you don't hear them inside the car.
And not only that, when Johnny was backing up one day, I thought it was the garbage truck. It really was. It was so now, one thing that we both did, and when I did it, because I did it first, Johnny got aggravated, and then when he did it, of course, it was just okay. It was just fine. But what we were driving to Raleigh Airport to pick Dave up, and when I went to, what was it? I was changing the fan from 3 bars to 2 bars or something, and my pinky touched the fabulous 10.25-inch digital instrument cluster screen with navigation and with Android Auto and Apple CarPlay. And my pinky touched the screen, and I lost the navigation map. And
you get a picture right in the middle of it, like, oh, is this where you want to go? And it just stops.
And you got to reprogram it so that you don't, you know, so that you're back on your navigation control. That was a little too, you can't avoid it, and it was a little too close, those two control systems. But I mean, again, we're talking about nothing here. So, again, beautifully designed. It's elegant. It's spacious. It holds a tremendous amount of luggage, cargo, gross.
75 cubic feet of cargo space with the back seats down.
So,
nice.
Before we go into all of the wonderful things that this car has,
I want you to talk about the safety things, but before you talk about the next thing, I want to go back to the fact that you were turning the air conditioning down, and I have a question for Hezzy. Hezzy, when you're driving a vehicle, should be comfortable, the driver or the passenger?
I do not believe you're bringing this up.
Believe.
I'm afraid of getting in the middle of a major crisis here, and
okay,
I don't get paid enough to even go there.
Driver should be the comfortable one. He has the responsibility for all the passengers in the car. Therefore, if anyone should be the most comfortable, should be the driver.
Well, I can only admit to that if Lori is not here. And then when Lori's here, I could say, no, it's you're the passenger. So you have to be the one that's comfortable.
I mean, this, this, this,
it's a hard choice.
Like,
a Solomonic equation here.
The wife has to cleave to her husband. The passenger has to cleave to the driver. Give me a break, Johnny. Let's go with the old...
My world, people.
Let's go with the old adage, ladies first.
Yeah, and last and in the middle, too.
One thing that Hedges is going to love, and this is what we see time and time again with Hyundai, which is why we love them so much. Tremendous bang for your buck, but everything is included. Hezzy, get ready for your big line. Everything is included except for what?
But?
Floor mats.
That's right.
Are they still $125 extra?
$195.
You're kidding. They raised the price on floor mats?
Well, you know, it's
what's
we just
going
paid
on here?
Well, yesterday they announced that the feds were raising interest rates by 0.75 percentage point. Of course they're going to increase.
That's true.
But this said, now, there was one other, and that was quartz white paint was a $400 extra. Other than that, everything is included for a tad under $43,000. I mean, again, it's such incredible value. And these cars, they're not – I mean, so many – products that we have in our lives are built with expiration dates. What's it called, Johnny? When you have planned expiration.
Planned obsolescence?
Yeah, that's it.
Planned obsolescence. But Hyundai doesn't understand that that's something that, you know, means that somebody would have to buy a car. In fact, these cars are built like tanks. They're built to last the long haul. And so Johnny, I'm going to go ahead and start talking about individual features and the safety. So if you want to bow out so that you and Dave and Ray's also with us, I think Ray's in the living room, and Ray is our fishing expert. The three are outdoor gurus.
So let's see if I understand this. You want me to get off so you can talk about me on the air when I'm not here. Is that it?
Pretty much.
That's
what I thought. Okay. Talking to you.
All right. So just you and
here,
me, Andy.
Take care, guys. What a pleasure. Nice
here we go.
You,
so,
Dave.
Okay, here we go. With the 2022 Tucson, you still there, Hezzy?
Yes, ma'am.
There you go. Yeah,
absolutely.
With this Hyundai 2022 Tucson Limited PHEV all-wheel drive, and all-wheel drive is important for an SUV like this. This is a midsize SUV. It's not a gigantic one. It's certainly not compact. But the reason why it's so important to have all-wheel drive, you may live, and this car is for everywhere. It's city, it's suburban, it's country, it's rural. Never think that you need all-wheel drive because you're going off-road or you're going into the mountains or you're going up great altitudes. Never think that. All-wheel drive has tremendous practical purposes in when road conditions are questionable, when you're involved in mud, rain. Now, remember, in ice, and thank God we're not dealing with that here in 101-degree weather in Pinehurst right now, but ice, no car can manipulate ice. If you're caught on black ice, doesn't matter if you have all-wheel drive. You're going to skid no matter what you've got. So, but the point is, with all-wheel drive, you have that much better control over your road conditions. So, again, I can't help but harp back to this price, $42,700, and here's what you get. Johnny wanted to talk about advanced safety technology, and if I read it straight through, all that it has, I'll start hyperventilating because the list is so long. So you name it, it's got it. And here we go. Forward collision avoidance assist. That is so valuable because, really, you can say, okay, I've got really razor-sharp, you know, instincts, or I can react, my reactions, but we don't react as fast as machinery, and this technology is being assist. That can be a pain in the neck. There's a way to turn off the little buzz sound that happens if you go over a line when you're driving. But frankly, if you're tired, if your focus is a little bit not on the road, and please, people, I can't tell you enough, you don't text And if you have to talk while you drive, you do it so that it's you've hooked into your system. It's remote. You're not holding a phone against your ear. You've got it plugged mm-hmm. into your phone. So when you have this kind of spontaneous reaction from the car, then the lane keeping assist, as I said, you can turn off the buzzing sound, but it's gonna get you back on track. And God knows what would happen if you went off track. The driver attention warning in the ultrasonic rear occupant alert. This is when you've got a child in the back, and maybe that child has gotten out of the seatbelt or the car seat. Again, it's going to tell you what's going on with your passengers inside your car. Blind spot collision, avoidance assist. Again.
You know, there were some people in New York who forgot that they had a child in the car. Can you imagine?
Well,
in the back seat?
This car will even tell you to check the back seat if you forgot a bag of groceries or even your purse.
Exactly. Exactly.
And these tragedies that you do read about in the news with children, it's no technology in a car is going to save you from stupidity.
No.
And
exactly.
negligence. And that's what that's all about. The rear cross traffic collision avoidance assist, safe exit warning, meaning when you get out of your car, you'll be, you know, if somebody, as you're opening the door in your line of fire. Electronic stability control, that's part of your traction with your all-wheel drive. ABS with electronic brake force distribution, as I said, I'm reading down this huge list, and I can go on and on. It's got it all. Let's just leave it at that. The design of the car, as I said, is lovely. We have had cars where the front grille looks like somebody, you know, pumped testosterone into it. And those heavily designed grills, cars with lots of chrome, to me, that is now outdated design. The cars that are coming down the pike that have more fluid design, less chrome, a grill that's attractive but not, you know, heavy and you know, you can't miss looking at it, those, I think, are a thing of the past. We're seeing far more sleek design. We always refer to it as European styling, and I guess that's true even though we're talking about Hyundai. The car also has a fabulous panoramic sunroof, beautiful. And it has LED headlights, which we're seeing more and more of with high beam assist, which means it's nighttime, you're driving, your headlights will go on high beam as you get into a darker place. So you're driving, there are no lights along the roadway, maybe a deer crosses in front of you. Those high beams are going to capture that. That actually is a feature that very much is a safety feature. The rear privacy glass, again, included, which is incredible to me. It's often extra with other cars, but I like that idea of the privacy glass because, believe it or not, I'll put some second seat and know that nobody can actually look in and want to take it, although we always lock the cars. for comfort and convenience, the leather trim seat, as I said, it's gray on gray, but it's very stylish. The driver has a three-way memory seat, so when I get on in the car, I press number one, Johnny presses number two or vice versa, and the seat adjusts to the way we've set our personal preferences. Then the usual stuff, leather-wrapped heated steering wheel. The driver's seat has lumbar support, and why is that important? Because if you're over 60, you know it is, and on and on and on. So it's a fabulous vehicle. We can't say enough, but, you know, Johnny just said that. He had read an article this morning about the cost of these electric cars is outweighing the benefits of trying to improve the environment because of such things as getting a battery that's going to be efficient and having to dispose of that battery. I don't know. I don't know where we're really going. You just can't – I do not think you can clearly say, oh, I'm going to get an electric car and feel good about it. However, I can say with all authority, I'm going to get a hybrid car that's going to save me because of the electric capability on gas consumption, then I'm all for it. So Full marks almost across the board, as always, for Hyundai. And Johnny and I both love it. So that's the end of our time, and we'll talk to you next week, Kezi.
What a pleasure. Really always is. And Hyundai, I've already forgiven them about the
Format.
So I'm good. I'm good there.
I know that's a real thorn in your side, Hezzy, and you know, but I now know what I'm going to get you for Hanukkah next year.
Format.
I'm going to get you. Yeah, I'm going to get you. You can put them in the bathroom. You don't have to worry about the car, okay?
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Format's a floor mat. All right. We love you. We'll talk to you next week. Listeners,
love you back.
Safe week.
All
cool,
the best.
And
thank
talk
you.
To you soon. Bye.
Take care. Be well. There we have it, folks. None other than Lori Wiles and her husband, who left a little bit earlier because he's with David, and they're having a discussion. He's from New York visiting, so always, always a pleasure speaking to them. And it's great to hear about the 2022 Tucson Limited PHEV all-wheel drive. And they seem to have a very unique perspective, which is very, very personal. And I think that makes them very, very, compelling is the best word for what they do and their reviews. Really, really good stuff. All right, well, let's move on to a couple of other things as we're going to be moving forward. And we'll try to find out a couple of things that you may find interesting. Bear with me a second here. I wanted to check one other thing because I'd forgotten. Yeah, this thing I found very, very compelling. Someone that we know for many years now, Annette Rodriguez-Weir, she wrote an article, because she rarely does, but she wrote an article called Lessons I Learned from My Parents. So she was born in Esconset, New York, which is out in Long Island. She writes, when I was a teenager, I didn't think about the price of things. For example, I didn't think about whether I would have enough to eat or if our home, which was small, was different from the homes of others. I just went along living my life because I had two parents, and they always managed to make things work for us. There were times when I would take my mom to the store to shop for food, and I always winced at her bringing coupons and checking the prices of everything. After all, that was for people who were poor, so I thought. She was also very careful where she shopped. There would be one store for the staple items and another for meat that was a better quality. AMP was a lesser expensive store for vegetables and some of the staple items like bread. Wonder Bread with the red and blue balloon designs on the package. Bohack was the Tom Thumb of that era with higher priced items, and their meats were of higher quality, and my mom was very careful about the meats we ate. My father made me cringe when he would ask my older sister, who lived across the street from us, for her newspaper when she was finished with it. I couldn't help thinking, why can't he just buy his own? It just seemed to me that my parents were always watching their pennies very closely. I never gave a thought of what it was like bringing up four children with only one breadwinner in the home. Of course, in those days, it was traditional for mothers to be the homemakers or taking care of the kids' needs, paying bills, and keeping an eye on the budget. Fast forward to today, I went to the grocery store to pick up a few things for breakfast and got the shock of my life when some of the things I typically could purchase for a reasonable sum had tripled in price. I was jolted back in time. Although I never had to raise a family, I never had to watch the pennies because I only had myself to take care of. It suddenly occurred to me that there are so many people that are really struggling to make ends meet, and this inflation is just eating them up alive. In fact, while I was shopping, there was a tiny elderly woman that was, I would say, a bit on the skinny side. At least that's what I saw when she raised her arm to reach for a loaf of bread off the shelf, which she examined closely to determine price. I couldn't help but think, here is a person being chastised for being for something she had nothing to do with. Why? She is probably one of the people you hear about that must make a choice between medication and food, and it pained my heart to think of that. When my parents were just starting out in their married life, they had to go through the Depression, which I believe left a mark on their minds forever. And those of us who are post-Depression children were spared that painful experience because life improved immensely in the country by the time we came of age. When I was first married, there was no thought of the price of things, at least not for me, because, again, I was taking care of myself. My former husband, being a frugal German, believed in each of us taking care of our own things. He paid the mortgage, but all other expenses were paid according to the needs of each of us individually. It was okay because I wasn't hurting and we had plenty of do-re-mi. However, when I was on my own again, I could plainly see how being a bit frugal, or I prefer calling it self-conscious of how you spend, made more sense in the long run. The economy we keep hearing about every evening on the news never seems to improve, and the thought that there are Americans who are truly in need, not because of their actions, not because of the actions of a socialist-inclined administration in Washington, makes one fearful of the future. Add to that the onslaught of illegal immigrants flooding into our country, being given free food, baby formula, housing, health care, education, etc., and you start to wonder if our elected officials are on our side or are they purposely trying to harm us. I always had enough faith in our government to believe that although there were differences between political parties, they were all patriotic Americans, so they'd work together for the good of the nation. I'm not certain anymore. Getting back to my parents, they always seemed to handle things with courtesy and kindness. Even when unexpected company would drop by, they'd have more than enough to whip up a dinner for them. And more importantly, they never accumulated debts, preferring to save their shekels until they could afford the items. And how did they do it? As I think back, They would always give to others and look little for themselves and took little for themselves. Carlos and Esther Rodriguez, her parents, didn't have many material things, but they knew how to make the most of what they did have. And rather than complain about the price of things, they learned how to budget their income and be more prudent in their selection of items. Yet I believe it was more than that. I think it was their strong faith in God that turned a stumbling block into a stepping stone. I feel eternally blessed by the principled legacy they passed on to me and my siblings. And that's so heartwarming to read. And it's absolutely beautiful to reflect as she did. So I'm very, very pleased. Now let's just look and see some other things that you might want to know about. Bear with me a second. One second here. And this I wanted to read to you because we may not have covered it as much, even though we spoke about this yesterday. The Changing Nature of Work and the Death of American Cities. It was written by socioeconomic research scholar Orrin M. Levin Waldman. So we did a radio show on this. So if you look up Orrin Levin Waldman, you'll find the link to this particular program, and you could listen to it if you'd like. So he writes, in the wake of the COVID pandemic, the nature of work has changed. More and more workers are able to work remotely, and those who can have no real desire to return to traditional office-based 9-to-5 schedules. On the contrary, many workers have found themselves to be quite productive from afar and have even moved from high-cost living metropolitan areas like New York to lower-cost areas in places like North Carolina. For those who have been commuting 4 hours a day, there is little incentive to return to the office if it can be avoided. This, of course, raises an interesting question. With this changing nature of work, are we beginning to see the death of American cities? American cities arose on the basis of what was called agglomeration economies. That is, in order for there to be commerce, firms needed to be in close proximity to other firms. To communicate before, there were telecommunications people who had to be within walking distance of others. And firms also needed to be relatively close to the marketplace because of the high cost of transportation. Well, the first American cities like Philadelphia, New York, and Boston were port cities because they were developed along the ports where goods could be loaded and unloaded for export and import. It wasn't until the steam engine was invented and plane tracks were laid across the country that Midwestern cities arose. Chicago was developed as a train hub. Initially, our major cities were relatively small and concentrated around transportation lines in the central business district, the CBD. But as the cost of transportation decreased, cities began to spread out. The problem with being concentrated around the central business district was that land was expensive and workers couldn't afford to live too close to their jobs unless they were renting in some type of tenement, in which case a plot of land would house more people. As transportation costs decreased, workers could spread out, and so too could the wealthy, as they too could get housing for their more housing for their money. As goods began to be shipped via trucks along the nation's highways, firms could more easily ship goods to markets across the country, and as advance in technology, first through telephones, made communications such that it was no longer necessary to be in close proximity to one another, firms too could move not only across the country, but also out of the country. With further advances in communications technology, mainly satellites, internet, and now Zoom, firms could be located in one place and workers, as we have recently discovered, in another. In other words, do we need cities any longer? We don't need to be in close proximity to conduct normal commerce. Firms in the U.S. now have workers telecommuting from halfway around the world, which is to say there need to be other reasons for cities to exist. A city like New York is simply too expensive for most workers to live in, although there may be reasons to come into the city for cultural events and entertainment. The hassle factor may simply be too great for many. Consider, for example, a couple living in northern New Jersey. To come into the city to see a play involves a couple of hours of travel on either end, plus the high cost of parking. The same couple go in the other direction and see plays in Princeton with much less hassle. Add to this the growing crime rate in New York City and the desire to come into the city no longer exists. In fact, the growing crime rate wave could be a factor in many workers saying that they would rather not come at all. Increasingly, more workers are refusing to come back to the office despite calls by local officials across the country to come back. It isn't only office workers who are refusing to come back. Workers in the hospitality industry are also refusing to go back to the on the grounds that their pay is low and their working conditions aren't great. From the employer's perspective, they want employees around so that they can be in control and to ensure that work is being performed. Some might argue that productivity is less through remote work. And yet productivity could be higher because employees, not wasting large swaths of time commuting, can devote more attention to their work. Also, the increased morale that may attend to allowing workers to continue work from home will result in greater productivity because they feel better about their jobs. Employers in high-cost cities like New York City are also discovering that if they allow workers to work remotely, they can save considerable amounts of money on office space. They can move into smaller spaces and save millions of dollars in rent a year. None of this necessarily bodes well for the survival of the city. So if the nature of work is changing, with fewer people returning, quote unquote, to work, and more people moving out because they work remotely from several hundred miles away or even more, we might be seeing the beginning of the process of the death of the great American cities. More businesses over the years have moved out from the core central city to the periphery, such as suburban communities. Cities have already lost the draw they once had. Now more people can work and live in the suburbs, and the only time they come into the city is to enjoy the arts. But many art centers, along with restaurants, have been moving to the suburbs. If we add to that the manufacturing activities which defined many cities, particularly in the Northeast and Midwest industrial belts, the advances in technology which have now changed the nature of work only finishes off many of those cities. Remember that cities as we have known them formed out of necessity, but that necessity no longer exists. Large cities like New York, Chicago, and L.A. will survive in some form, but we may be seeing the death of mid-sized cities, and these trends can only exacerbate much of the poverty and decay left behind, and many of the social pathologies that have been plaguing American cities for decades now. It is ironic, then, that the technological advances which have been the source of our city's strength may be the source of their destruction as well. And this was written by Oren M. Levin-Waldman, Ph.D. He's a socioeconomic research scholar. You could find him online at www.econlabor.com. So www.econlabor.com. You'll find it really brilliant. He's really quite brilliant and really quite prophetic. Now, let me just quickly look at a couple of other things that you may find of interest. Bear with me a moment here. I want to do some international stuff that you might find of value. Here it is. Evidently, Scholz and European leaders in Kiev back Ukraine's application for the European Union candidate status. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, along with Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Romanian President Klaus Iohannis, decried Russia's attacks during their joint trip to Ukraine. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi are attending a press conference with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. You can watch part of the conference live, of course, and albeit tape delayed for security reasons, in the window at the top of the story. So Germany's Scholz said that the government in Berlin backed Kyiv's bid for European Union candidate status. Francis Macron said, "We all four support the immediate European Union candidate status." Candidate status is not the same as European Union membership. It denotes the start of an often lengthy process of the European Union. European leaders condemned Russian brutality and surveyed the destruction in the nearby town of Irpin. Scholz said that the town had witnessed, quote, unimaginable cruelty, end quote, senseless violence, end quote. Mass graves were found in the town of Bucha, which also lies near Kyiv, which is the capital. Macron condemned the barbarism, quote unquote, of Russian attacks and praised the local residents who fought back against Russia's failed attempt to take territory surrounding the capital. Draghi vowed the country will be rebuilt with European help. Quote, they destroyed the nurseries, the playgrounds, and everything will be rebuilt, the Italian leader said. In a Twitter post, Iohannis wrote that there are, quote, no words to describe the unimaginable human tragedy and horrible destruction in Irpin. It's an important moment. It's a message of unity we're sending to the Ukrainians, Macron said shortly after the leaders arrived by train. The trip comes amid criticism that European countries such as Germany are not doing enough to help Ukraine fend off the invasion. German Defense Minister Christine Lambrecht said on Wednesday that Berlin would provide Ukraine with three M270 multiple launch rocket systems, known in German as Mars 2, one fewer than the four units Berlin had initially planned to send. So there's a lot of stuff going on. Now, 1 second. Bear with me a moment as I move on to some other issues. And this is important to recognize as well. Question is, why do the world leaders take the night train to Kiev? Well, the German chancellor arrived in the Ukrainian capital by rail on Thursday morning, alongside the French president and Italian premier. Such a trip is a security headache, but there are few alternatives. On Tuesday, March 15th of 2022, the war in Ukraine had already been raging for 3 weeks. Russian troops had approached to within a few kilometers of the capital of Kyiv, trying to break through its defenses from the north and west, and the city had been rocked by heavy shelling in the morning and was at risk of being encircled. And then came the news that several European Union leaders had arrived in the Ukrainian capital to pay a surprise visit. Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki and his deputy Jarosław Kaczynski, the leader of Poland's ruling PIS party, had traveled by train with the Slovenian and Czech leaders Janusz Janša and Petr Fiala. The picture of them poring over a map of Ukraine while on board went viral. They then met Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the bunker under his official residence. It had been important to keep the journey secret, given the danger that the leaders could fall victim to a Russian attack. Well, there were few alternatives to rail. Though Russian troops have now withdrawn from the greater Kyiv area, it is still difficult to travel to the Ukrainian capital by any other means than by rail. The airspace over Ukraine has been closed since the February 24 invasion. Many roads are still barely accessible due to heavy fighting, and thus the railway has established itself as the best means of transporting politicians from around the world to Kyiv. The first historic trip to the Central and Eastern European leaders was followed by visits by the top politicians, including European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Canadian Premier Justin Trudeau, and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Several German politicians have also traveled to Ukraine, including Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock and opposition leader Friedrich Merz. After some doing and froing, Chancellor Olaf Scholz also decided to make the trip, along with French President Emmanuel Macron and Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi. It was a perilous journey. Although fighting has now shifted mainly to eastern Ukraine, a journey to Kyiv by train is not without risk. Russian missile strikes continue to rain down on tracks, bridges, and provincial train stations, particularly in order to disrupt arms supplies. When foreign politicians travel to Kyiv by train, they often get on a Ukrainian train for the last leg of their journey from the Polish border because European and Ukrainian rail track widths are different. Delegations are usually accompanied by their own national security personnel as well as Ukrainian security guards. Well, secrecy is not always maintained. Secrecy is supposed to be part of the utmost importance. The April visit of U.S. Secretary of State Blinken and U.S. Defense Minister Lloyd Austin was first made public only afterwards for fear of a Russian missile attack. Thus, Ukrainian and Polish security teams must have been displeased when Polish Prime Minister Morawiecki announced his visit while still en route to Kyiv. The chairman of Ukrainian Railways, Oleksandr Kamyshyn, later told U.S. broadcaster CNN that the show of solidarity was welcome, but it had been a little rash to advertise it till early. And that was really important for us, even if it was naive, he said. Since the invasion, Kamyshyn and his colleagues have been operating from a train that constantly changes its location. He said that he did not even tell his kids and advised them not to reveal their location either. everyone should understand that this is war, but I can't instruct prime ministers. Nor can he give orders to European Commission presidents, apparently. Ursula von der Leyen also announced her visit ahead of time on Twitter. On the same day that a Russian missile attack of a train station in the city of Kramatorsk in eastern Ukraine killed over 50 people. The starting point of her journey was also made known in advance. The train station in the Polish town of Przemysl, just around 13 kilometers from the Ukrainian border. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's visit took place almost at the same time. It had been planned for weeks, but was postponed several times for security reasons. It, too, was not supposed to be made public until afterwards, but it was the Ukrainian embassy in London that tweeted a picture of Johnson until he was while he was still in Kiev with Zelensky. Luxury sleeper cars for VIPs. Says even if secrecy is maintained, the Ukrainian railroad company cannot guarantee its VIP guests complete safety and that there will not be a missile attack. But it does try to make delegations as comfortable as possible. According to a report by Radio Free Europe, one of the luxury carriages used in the past few months was built in 2014 to take wealthy tourists to Crimea. It probably served this purpose only a few times before the peninsula was annexed by Russia the same year. Other carriages being used date back to the Soviet era, which were modernized a few years ago, and many feature king-size beds and flat-screen televisions, and those used as meeting rooms have upholstered seats and leather armchairs. But not everyone is given the full VIP treatment. German conservative opposition leader Friedrich Merz traveled to the Ukrainian capital in a first-class sleeper car with only a narrow bed and fold-out desk. Nonetheless, this was presumably considerably more comfortable than some of the sleeper cars that still have wooden beds. After arriving, the politicians do not usually spend much more than a few hours in Kyiv. And this might give them time to meet President Zelensky, visit the war-ravaged suburbs, and perhaps enjoy a meal. Johnson, for example, ate chicken soup, a goat's cheese salad, roast beef, and cherry dumplings for dessert. What is crucial is the symbolism, the photos, the words and gestures of solidarity, and most importantly, the assurances that a political, that a politician's country stands firmly with Ukraine, then it's back on the tracks for a long journey through a war-torn land. Yeah, that is the tragedy of it all. Unbelievable. Now, let's just look and see why, for example, the United States can't get the Middle East to support it on Ukraine. The United States and European Union would like Saudi Arabia to pump more oil and the United Arab Emirates to stop hiding Russian oligarchs, superyachts, and assets, but they won't, even though the U.S. is still the dominant military power in the region. So it's been a serious snub. Shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine in late February, U.S. officials supposedly tried to organize a phone call between U.S. President Joe Biden and the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudi crown prince, often referred to simply as MBS, apparently refused to take the call. Shortly afterwards, however, MBS spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and the following month he also spoke to Chinese President Xi Jinping. Well, the White House later denied Biden's calls had been rebuffed, but in many ways it didn't matter, because this was only the latest incident in a particularly chilly period in the relationship between the United States and some of its closest oil-producing friends in the Middle East. In the recent past, Biden has described Saudi Arabia as a pariah state, quote-unquote, a commentary on the allegedly state-orchestrated murder of Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, as well as the country's dismal overall human rights record. So, hoping to be reunited with Saudi Arabia and other partners, it seems that the problem is that now, thanks to the war in Ukraine, the United States needs Saudi Arabia and its neighbors once again. The U.S. and Europe would like their partners in the Middle East to do things like pump more oil in order to lower global prices, support various United Nations resolutions opposing the invasion of Ukraine, and assist with sanctions on Russia. But they are reluctant. Oil-rich nations like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are mostly sticking to production limits previously agreed with the OPEC Plus group, which includes Russia. and super yachts, private jets, and Russian oligarchs' assets are being sheltered from seizure in the United Arab Emirates and other countries in the region, including U.S. allies Iraq, Jordan, and Israel, declined to vote against Russia at the United Nations Security Council. So why is it that the U.S., a major player in the Middle East for decades, has not been able to persuade its supposed friends to take its side? Since the end of World War II, the United States has traded its military might for energy security in the region. And as an April report from the European Council on Foreign Relations, the ECFR, pointed out, the United States remains the dominant security guarantor and largest exporter of arms to the region. And the U.S. still has large military bases around the Middle East and between 45,000 to 60,000 personnel stationed there. Its presence dwarfs that of other players, as ECFR noted, European Council on Foreign Relations. However, when the Americans started Own Oil at Home, which began in 2019, the United States has exported more petroleum than it imports. Middle Eastern oil producers became less relevant. I would argue that over the last 20 years, while the U.S. has not withdrawn from the region, priorities have changed, said Aaron D. Miller, a former foreign policy advisor to the United States government and senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Well, the Middle East is still very important, just not quite as important as it was, Miller told Deutsche Welle. There is no question that our regional partners began to feel that their primary benefactors and patrons were paying them less attention, he explained. And that has produced a situation where key states, the Saudis and the Emiratis in particular, have sought to reach out to others. China, for example, is by far the largest importer of oil, and in 2020, 47% of its imports came from the Middle East. The Asian superpower has been strengthening its relationship there, including helping develop ballistic missiles in Saudi Arabia, buying up Iraqi oil production facilities, and investing in Iraqi infrastructure. These are sovereign countries that have interests that are often not aligned with ours, and we are not the only game in town, confirmed Bilal Saab, the director of the Defense and Security Program at the Washington-based Middle East Institute, or MEI. They have other options. These may not be as good as the U.S., but they're there. However, as the Ukraine war goes on and the global economic situation worsens, partially due to high oil prices, the U.S. is trying to reclaim the ground it has lost to others like China and Russia. High-level delegation led by U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, visited the United Arab Emirates in mid-May and met with Emirati leader Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan after the death of his half-brother. And this week, U.S. media reported that the U.S. President himself would visit Saudi Arabia in mid-July for meetings with Saudi leader MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, something Biden has previously appeared reluctant to do. Well, if we wanted to play hardball, presumably we could, said Miller, who worked at the U.S. State Department for over two decades, advising various administrations on Middle East policy, but wanted us to deal with Middle Eastern countries for 40 years, and rarely, if ever, do we bring that kind of pressure to bear on a country when it's a matter of their own vital national interest. Instead, what's needed is, quote, smart, adept alliance management, end quote, Miller had argued, something he believes is now underway. The MEI's Saab thinks there's progress, too, with actions like deploying the high-level delegation to the United Arab Emirates. And in terms of further persuasion, there are plenty more areas where the U.S. can demonstrate how cooperation can be mutually beneficial, he added. Well, one of those areas is integrated air and missile defense. The author of the recently published book, Rebuilding Arab Defense, U.S. Security Cooperation in the Middle East, said this is something that countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates need, thanks to missile attacks from Yemen, including one which shut down almost half of all Saudi oil production in 2019. But if there were to go down the path of acquiring or possibly developing ballistic missiles with the help of the Chinese, then they may not help an integrated air missile defense, Saab had suggested. So underestimating the European Union. It seems that the European Union should also play a role. As you love it, a Middle East expert and senior policy fellow at the ECFR advised, the European Union seems content to let the U.S. administration do most of the heavy lifting, he said. But in fact, Europeans have plenty to offer, particularly in terms of things like development support, humanitarian aid, foreign direct investment, trade, and security. So while Chinese and Russian contributions are often over-exaggerated, European contributions are often underappreciated, including by Europeans themselves, Lovett had cautioned. There is a need to instill a more general sense that the West remains committed to the region in a way that goes beyond the current preoccupation with narrow self-interest, he said. So the MEI Saab would prefer to see a reset of U.S. relationships with former or rather important Middle Eastern partners. The previously transactional model, Saab calls it the Oil for Security Covenant, where the U.S. simply came to the rescue, no longer applies. We need a renewed partnership on new terms, where each party has obligations and responsibilities and is sensitive to collective and regional security interests, he argued, and I would certainly want them in our corner again because they play important roles in the strategic competition with China and Russia. It would be great to add these countries in the long list of those prepared to oppose Russia with sanctions, Miller agreed, but that may be unrealistic. The former U.S. foreign policy advisor had said, advocating a more pragmatic approach, I think when this all sorts itself out, in some way, we're going to end up with a sort of Cold War 2.0, but one where many countries in the world are not going to be willing to choose sides. So, yeah, that's part of the problem. So we're going to have to see where all that goes. Now, one second. Bear with me a second. One moment here. Okay, this is going to be very interesting. There's an opinion piece. Northern Ireland Protocol, seems that Boris Johnson gets out the chainsaw. British Prime Minister is ripping the Northern Ireland Protocol out of Brexit. And this breach is an act of political insanity and is further proof of Boris Johnson's utter irresponsibility, said Barbara Vessel. So when Boris Johnson survived his party's vote of confidence over the Partygate affair earlier this month, opinion was divided as to his political future. And some believed that he could not rest assured with his grip on power secure. Others feared that he would act even more irresponsibly in an effort to please party hardliners. Unfortunately, it seems the skeptics were right. United Kingdom Prime Minister is now wantonly going after the Northern Ireland Protocol, the most sensitive element of the Brexit agreement, not with a political axe, but with a political chainsaw. International treaties are binding and cannot simply be changed unilaterally. In terms of international law, such a breach of contract could never be trivial, no matter what Boris Johnson may claim, for it destroys trust among states. Yet once again, it seems the Prime Minister thinks he can just ignore the rules. He thinks that all he needs to do is invent an emergency clause, quote unquote, to disable the Northern Ireland Protocol by claiming the treaty is not working and is instead hindering trade between mainland Britain and Northern Ireland. And here's a quick refresher on this, the most difficult chapter of Brexit negotiations. A solution was needed to avoid creating a border between the Republic of Ireland, a European Union member state, and Northern Ireland in order to maintain the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. At the same time, the European Union wanted to make sure it protected its single market and the rules governing it by ensuring that no British goods could enter it uncontrolled. The result was a compromise obliging the United Kingdom to comply with certain controls, and which Johnson called excellent, quote-unquote, at the time he signed the Brexit deal. Well, the Prime Minister's claim that the agreement is unworkable is, despite some bureaucratic hurdles, simply untrue. In fact, Northern Ireland appears to be enjoying the best of both worlds. It has remained in the European single market despite Brexit, while at the same time being able to trade freely with the United Kingdom. Northern Ireland's current economic development is second in the United Kingdom only to Greater London. Northern Ireland trade associations and the majority of its politicians oppose Johnson's approach. Well, the European Commission has said it will sue the United Kingdom if it goes through with its latest threat. The paperwork for such a step was filed with the European Court of Justice, the ECJ, last summer. And should proceedings be launched, the United Kingdom would likely face financial penalties. The European Union has said that if the United Kingdom denies payment, Brussels will slap tariffs on British goods. The result would be a full-on trade war. And the European Union has already fired the first warning shots, temporarily suspending special agreements governing fishing rights and scientific cooperation. Patience has run out in Brussels because Boris Johnson is clearly a repeat offender. From the start, his government has consistently worked to undermine an agreement that is negotiated and signed. A number of further negotiations have been held since last summer, with the European Union making some concessions. But for months, talks have been on ice as the British government has refused to come back to the table. And London appears to be seeking to sabotage negotiations in order to justify withdrawing from the treaty altogether. And Brussels has accused London of dealing in bad faith. As lawyers would say, mal fide. So Europe is currently fighting rising energy prices, inflation, and extreme political stress as a result of the war in Ukraine. That applies to every country without exception. In this situation, the European Union and the United Kingdom need a trade war like they need the plague. It is an act of political insanity for which there is simply no excuse. And Boris Johnson, however, is guided by party and domestic political to satisfy far-right Brexiteers in his own party as well as its allies in the Northern Irish DUP, who have blocked the formation of a government in Stormont since their election defeat in early May. It is doubtful that the threat of breaching Brexit will achieve that purpose, and behind the habitual gambler Johnson is betting on it nevertheless, irresponsibly out of self-interest and with the players' willingness to take risks. Once again, the British Prime Minister is proving that he's unfit for the job. If Johnson is run out of Downing Street this year, Europe will breathe a sigh of relief. So these are some of the issues which is happening. Now let's look at something that might be easier to look at from abroad rather than to look at from what's happening here in the United States. It seems that the COVID numbers are rising in Germany, and the question is, who cares? COVID-19 is spreading again in Germany, and medical experts are already looking ahead to the colder months and fear that Germany will not be prepared for the virus to return with force. So people in Germany are spending their summer with COVID-19 out of their mind, or out of mind, if not out of sight. And with most restrictions now lifted, they are traveling and filling bars, restaurants, and clubs. Festivals and other events are taking place again, and many are trying to make up for lost time. In fact, confirmed cases and hospitalizations are higher now than at the same time in either of the last 2 years, but Germany's third pandemic summer feels like the most normal. Like other countries, Germany is seeing an increase in coronavirus cases caused by the BA.5 subvariant, which the World Health Organization currently classifies as a, quote, variant of concern. Now, Health Minister Karl Lauterbach has spoken of a summer wave of new infections sweeping the country. And this has unfortunately become a fact, he told the Rheinische Post, a newspaper, on Twitter. He urged vulnerable individuals to get a fourth shot of the vaccine and suggested the wearing of masks in closed spaces. No one can say right now if Omicron will continue to dominate in the fall and winter, whether we'll have a harmless variant or one that causes serious cases, said Klaus Reinhardt, the president of the German Medical Association, the BAK, in a statement last week criticizing state and federal pandemic planning. Specifically, they and others in their field want to focus on keeping schools open, protecting the most vulnerable, boosting immunity, and ensuring normal operations of hospitals and other crucial infrastructure. Well, throughout the pandemic, doctors and researchers have lamented that Germany has been flying blind, quote unquote. The absence of reliable and consistent data is not a good basis for rational decisions, the statement had said. So the Doctors Association was speaking in support of a list of recommendations, foremost better data collection, put out by the so-called Expert Council, a multidisciplinary body set up to advise the government on its pandemic strategy. At the moment, this is no straightforward task, given the crossroads at which Germany finds itself. On the one hand, the country is benefiting from a high level of immunity, quote unquote, according to the report, and variants that caused relatively mild cases. On the other hand, that immunity may wane and a vaccination gap still persists, as rates haven't seen a significant bump in months. And those factors together could prove problematic in winter, especially if a variant emerges that is more dangerous than Omicron or its circulating sub-variants. Council laid out three scenarios for the coming fall, based primarily on the severity of the dominant variant. In the best case, infections remain mild and hospitals can cope with the patient load, including due to the normal flu season. At most, restrictions could be necessary only for at-risk people. In a worst-case scenario, hospitals would be overrun with life-threatening cases, then restrictions on social contact, and widespread use of masks would become necessary again. And vaccination centers would have to reopen for a fourth round of mass immunizations. The council has an in-between outlook, which calls for some mask use and capacity limits as public events, with the ad hoc addition of stricter measures in regions with more serious outbreaks. So it will be a job of state and federal leaders to translate experts' scientific recommendations into political decisions, and they have to take into account not just the pandemic, but knock-on economic and psychological effects. For example, a new study from the Kiel Institute, a German think tank, found that closing schools effectively slows the spread of the virus. However, it has also been detrimental to children being to child well-being. So less invasive steps, such as better communication with the public, a comprehensive test strategy, and medical tasks masks, could go a long way in controlling COVID-19, the study found, which looked at 14 non-medical measures in 182 countries in the first year of the pandemic. The government's initial impulse is to wait at least until the end of June before making decisions about the fall, and that's when another advisory group releases its evaluation of existing measures. And officials say they will then use the summer break to discuss with states about the way forward. I'm asking for a little bit of patience, but preparations for measures are currently underway. Sebastian Gülde, a spokesperson for the Federal Health Ministry, said in response to a Deutsche Welle inquiry, the current version of the federal law that regulates the government's power to enforce pandemic restrictions expires on September 23rd. And that sets up a parliamentary fight over changes between the three-party ruling coalition and the opposition, and that happened the last time the law was amended when the Social Democrat-led government was taking power in late fall and cases began to rise again. And critics said that the changes left states confused and with little authority to control the pandemic, and some measures had to be written back in after the fact. So the point is that when in doubt, vaccinate. The ruling parties themselves may not be on the same page. and several members of the Greens have advocated for getting ahead of any possible surge. The Free Democrats, in keeping with their laissez-faire approach to governing, have been more hesitant. Earlier this year, they opposed their partners in government and prevented a law on mandatory vaccinations for all adults. A mandatory vaccination exists only for certain groups of the population, such as health workers or soldiers. And the protection provided by COVID vaccines or past infection slowly decreases over time as antibody levels drop. So few infections, for example, with the variant BA5 are possible despite vaccinations or past infection. Well, the Federal Health Ministry, which the coalition leading Social Democrats run, has concerned itself largely with ensuring that Germany has enough vaccines on hand, although a second booster is so far not in the cards for the general population. An Omicron-specific vaccine will be available in the fall, the ministry spokesperson said. Originally, vaccine maker BioNTech said it would be ready for approval in April or May. So these are some of the issues that have come about. Now let's look at something which is probably very critical here at home. It seems that the U.S. Federal Reserve raised its key interest rate by 0.75 percentage points amid surging inflation. It's the largest jump in nearly three decades, with more hikes likely to come. Well, the U.S. Federal Reserve raised its benchmark borrowing rate on Wednesday by 0.75 percentage points. The move comes as the Fed seeks to combat inflation in the country, which has reached highs not seen in 40 years. Prices have risen sharply in the past year, initially because of supply chain problems due to the coronavirus pandemic, but subsequently because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So what did the Fed say? In a statement, the Fed's policy-setting Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, said that despite the interest rate hike, it remains strongly committed to returning inflation to its 2% objective. It's the Fed's largest interest rate rise since November of 1994, with the U.S. Central Bank signaling that it expects to make further hikes to the key rate in the future. The Federal Open Market Committee noted that effects Russia's invasion of Ukraine are creating additional pressure, upward pressure, on inflation and are weighing on global economic activity. The ongoing COVID-19 lockdowns in China are likely to exacerbate supply chain disruptions. Well, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell acknowledged that the 0.75 percentage point hike was an unusually large one, as the U.S. Central Bank was initially expected to approve a 0.5 percentage point increase. After looking at economic forecasts and the performance of the U.S. economy, the committee agreed that increasing the target range was warranted in this meeting. Powell said, although further hikes to the interest rates are anticipated, he does not expect major hikes like the one announced yesterday to become common. Rampant inflation in the United States is placing severe pressure on families, forcing them to pay much more for food, gas, and rent, while reducing their ability to afford discretionary items. The announcement from the world's biggest economy also comes amid rising inflation and economic uncertainty in markets around the world. The European Central Bank signaled plans to raise interest rates for the first time in 11 years, starting in July. And last week, Germany's central bank upped its inflation prediction for 2022 after inflation in the country hit its highest rate in almost 50 years in May at 7.9%. So, a worldwide problem, to say the least. One second, as we just look to a couple of other issues. Just see if there's anything else. Now, this is really quite interesting because I never would have imagined that. It seems North Korea sees an outbreak of unidentified disease amid the COVID wave. North Korea reported the outbreak of an unidentified intestinal epidemic. While it already faces food shortages and coronavirus infections, the outbreak was in the isolated nation's key agricultural region. So North Korea reported an outbreak of an unidentified intestinal epidemic on Thursday today, as the country is already struggling to cope with a wave of COVID infections and food shortages. State news agency reported leader Kim Jong-un sent his family's reserve medicines to the western port city of Haiju on Wednesday to help patients recovering from the acute epidemic. The term enteric refers to the gastrointestinal tract. Well, the agency did not share details about the disease, and the number of people affected was not specific either. Well, Kim stressed the need to contain the epidemic at the earliest date possible by taking a well-knit measure to quarantine the expected cases to thoroughly curb its spread. Confirming cases through epidemiological examination and scientific tests, the KCNA had said. So South Hwanghae province, where Haiju is located, is North Korea's key agricultural region. An official at South Korea's Unification Ministry said that the government is monitoring the outbreak suspected to be cholera or typhoid. North Korea declared state emergency last month amid its first reported COVID outbreak, and the isolated nation faces a shortage of vaccines and medical supplies. So while the possibility of infections spreading through crops appears low, he will be disinfecting water supply sources as the disease is likely waterborne. Yong Yong Sik, an infectious disease expert at Kaohsiung University at Gill Medical Center, told Reuters. Well, some observers told the Associated Press news agency the outbreak is likely to affect Kim's image as a leader caring about public livelihoods. KCNA said more than 4.5 million out of the country's 26 million people have fallen ill due to an unidentified fever, but that only 73 people died. And the country has identified only a fraction of those as confirmed coronavirus cases due to the apparent lack of test kits in the country. Pyongyang said the COVID-19 wave has shown signs of subsiding, yet the World Health Organization cast doubt on these claims earlier this month, saying it believes the situation is getting worse. And you can't believe them. That's really the big problem. Unbelievable. Okay. One more second here. Okay. And this is very interesting as well. The U.S. actor Kevin Spacey has been granted bail ahead of a plea hearing. It seems that Oscar-winning actor Kevin Spacey has been granted unconditional bail at a first hearing over sexual assault charges. His lawyer says that Spacey is determined to prove his innocence. A magistrate at London's Westminster Magistrates Court on Thursday granted Kevin Spacey unconditional bail until a next court appearance on July 14, as the acclaimed Hollywood actor faces charges on four counts of sexual assault against three men. Spacey has been charged with sexual offenses, including assault and non-consensual penetrative sexual activity in alleged incidents in London between March 2005 and August of 2008, and one in Western England in April 2013. At Thursday's hearing, the 62-year-old actor was not asked to make a formal plea, but his lawyer said that Spacey denied all allegations. Spacey starred in the well-known Netflix TV series House of Cards and has received Academy Awards for the 1995 film The Usual Suspects and for the 1999 movie American Beauty as Best Supporting Actor and Lead Actor, respectively. He ran London's Old Vic Theatre between 2004 and 2015. His career came to an abrupt end in 2017 when actor Anthony Rapp accused Spacey of assaulting him at a party in the 1980s when Rapp was a teenager. Spacey is one of the highest profile figures to be accused of sexual assault in connection with the Me Too, hashtag Me Too movement, which has been previously silenced, has seen many previously silent victims of sexual abuse speak out in a global wave of protest. The July 14 hearing, where Spacey is expected to be asked to make a plea, is scheduled to take place at Southwark Crown Court in South London. So we'll just have to see where all that goes. Bear with me a second here. A moment here. One minute. One second. Well, gee, got this right. One minute here. All right. Let me just see if we've covered all we can with you. All right. Let's see if there's anything else here. Well, this is really very interesting. I've not seen this movie, Lightyear. Apparently, there's a lesbian kiss, which sparks controversy in this movie. Pixar's new movie, Lightyear, is out this week, starring the beloved Toy Story character Buzz Lightyear. But the movie won't be shown in many Muslim countries or in China after Disney refused to cut a scene that shows two women sharing a kiss. So we're going to find out where that goes. And that's it. That's all it is. So the Disney Pixar film about Toy Story character Buzz Lightyear reportedly contains a scene including a same-sex kiss. Arab Emirates prohibited public screening, citing an unspecified content violation. So Lightyear, the animated movie based on the franchise series Toy Story, has been banned from cinemas in the United Arab Emirates, the country's media regulatory office announced on Monday. The Disney Pixar film about Toy Story character Buzz Lightyear reportedly contains a scene including a same-sex kiss. The film was banned for its violation of the country's media content standards, the office said on Twitter. Sharing a picture of the main character, Buzz Lightyear, covered by a no symbol. So the Emirati government did not state the specific violation of its content standards, but an Arabic hashtag Lightyear banned in the Emirates in posts complaining that the film contains portrayals of LGBTQ relationships was trending on Twitter. The film, which is expected to be released later this week, reportedly includes a scene of two female characters kissing. And the scene was initially taken out of the film, but later restored after complaints by Disney and Pixar employees, according to U.S. media. So Monday's announcement came just 6 months after the United Arab Emirates said it would stop censoring films and instead use a 21-plus age rating for content is classified for mature audiences. Well, the United Arab Emirates is seen as more liberal than other countries in the region that typically censor or edit other scenes it deems controversial in films. Saudi Arabia, for instance, recently banned the screening of Disney's Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness due to its LGBTQ references. So truly amazing. What's going on? One second. I think that we've covered everything. I think we really have covered everything we can for the day. I think that that's it. So. We'll speak to you tomorrow. Just see what we have for tomorrow because I don't remember. Let me see if we can look up under the calendar. See what we have for the calendar for tomorrow. I'm not sure. We'll have to recheck, but I think Assemblyman Nader Sage will be with us tomorrow from 10 to 11. So we'll see what's what with that. Anyway, so that's the story for us today. I want to thank you for being with us, your patience as well, and we'll go from there. So let me just say goodbye. Where are we here? Okay, here we are. So just have a great day, and we'll speak to you tomorrow. Bye.